Thank you so much, Joshua. I walked into the Gilo home the first night that I was here in Columbia, and a couple of the kids ran out, and one of them asked, "How many of us did you actually pull out of our mom's tummy?" And so I got far more credit for that than I deserved. But I did start with Truth Exchange in 2008. And when I started working for Truth Exchange, we didn't quite have the diagnostic term for how you would describe someone like me at the time. But in hindsight, I was totally woke. I was driving around with an Obama sticker on my car. I believed in hope and change. I had never asked myself, what was I being told to hope in? And what was I seeking to change and why? And so I made quite the impression every Sunday pulling into the church parking lot. But Dr. and Mrs. Jones hired me that September anyway, in spite of myself. And Rebecca had a sticker on her car at that time. I don't know if you remember this, Rebecca, but you had a, quote, "Yes on 8, protect our children" sticker. And the reason she had that sticker on her car is because Proposition 8 was on the ballot in California, and it actually passed. And what Proposition 8 was supposed to do was to change the Californian Constitution to define marriage as being between one man and one woman. I agreed with that. And like I said, we were amazed when it passed, and I voted yes because I was at least grounded enough in biblical truth to understand that, yes, indeed, marriage had been designed by God. It was between one man and one woman. It was important for us to set that down into our laws to reflect biblical reality. But at the same time, messages like Rebecca's sticker, "Protect Our Children, Vote Yes on 8, made me really, really uneasy. And they made me uneasy because I thought that we were being a little overwrought about things. Were we really endangering children? Don't be so dramatic. It's not like they're after our kids. I believed it when people said that we were being alarmists. I did kind of think that they were making slippery, sloped mountains out of molehills. I thought that people who were promoting gay marriage had a point when they asked us to, quote, stop the hate, and that told us that love is love. I hadn't stopped yet to consider, well, who defines love for us? So these messages went over very easily with me because I was a believer, but I had not been trained to think according to oneism and twoism. So much of what Rosaria was pointing out in her talk today. So I thought that that hand-wringing was really, really cringy. So much so that when Dr. Jones started letting me work as a volunteer and then as a brand spanking new employee at Truth Exchange, I had the audacity to go up to him and offer this helpful advice, maybe avoid the fringy issues. Like this one single boy that he had written about who lived in Massachusetts at the time and had been given the right to attend school dressed fully as a woman. Dr. Jones was probably right about some of the biblical implications about this one instance that he saw out there, most likely, and yet in my mind he was overblowing the whole thing. I stand here now and have to acknowledge that pleas for mere acceptance and equality have evolved quite quickly into something more far-reaching and more aggressive than I ever could have imagined. It turns out that that slope was really slippery after all. Now, institutional power is behind the movement, and we've seen medicine, education, sports, prisons, and even language itself be reshaped in the name of radical queer ideology. What Dr. Jones called a clamor for acceptance all the way back in 2000 has become outright demands with the weight of government, corporate, and judicial power behind it in much of Western culture. Some examples, merely off the top of my head as I was writing this talk. I personally know a family whose child was taken away by California's Child Protective Services because they would not put her on testosterone, and she now lives in a queer-affirming group home. They've had to flee the state to protect one of their other children because in Russian, they struggle because they have extremely gendered language, and that's something that the courts went after in my state of California. And so they wanted to protect their other child, and they're living elsewhere now while they try to get their daughter back. I know several parents in multiple states who've had CPS knock on their door and ask them questions about the non-affirming language that they use in their homes. I've interviewed a teacher who was formally reprimanded by her fellow Christian administrator for telling a mother about that mother's own daughter who was secretly being transitioned at school in sixth grade with no knowledge of by the mother, who knew that her daughter was emotionally distraught but couldn't understand exactly what was going on. I know women personally who now struggle to use the restroom without horrific pain because they took testosterone when they were minors. Their parents allowed them to do this because they had been convinced by the medical establishment that this was the only way to save their gender-confused child from suicide. I know several parents personally who had that line spoken to them. It's not a red state media talking point or MAGA talking point. Well, would you rather have a live son or a dead daughter? Would you rather have a live daughter or a dead son? Suicide is used to scare parents into allowing for these things. In Australia, a woman named Saul Grover is facing up to $120,000 in fines personally because she refused to let a man who identified as a woman on her female-only roommate job and ride-finding app. A lot of women use apps like these because they have experienced sexual assault and they have experienced trauma, and so it's important for them to have a driver who is female, unlike what you have in Lyft in San Francisco, where you can choose a female driver for your safety, but that person might be a man who is dressed as a female. So Sal is owing $120,000, even though she was pregnant with a child, and she is a single mom. She's facing all of these fines when all of this happened. In Los Angeles, a lifeguard captain was fired for refusing to raise the pride flag at his lifeguard station during Pride Month because of his Christian values. In Cabarrus County, forgive me if I'm not saying that correctly, up here in North Carolina, girls are begging for their high school restrooms to be made single sex again. They've described changing for sports in their cars and refusing to drink water during school hours so that they don't have to use the restroom with a male present. As I said, these are common issues that I am repeating to you off the top of my head, and I could give you so many more examples that I've had experience with personally. Dr. Jones was right, and I will now use the rest of my time telling all of you how I think that that's a pretty appropriate topic for the inaugural Peter Jones lectures. In his 2000 essay, Androgyny, The Pagan Sexual Ideal, Dr. Jones made this thesis statement: to understand the contemporary sexual revolution, we need to see the new sexuality as an integral expression of age-old religious paganism. In 2000, Dr. Jones focused mainly on the contemporary sexual revolution's homosexual expression, but he saw even then the transgender movement on the horizon, and it is now here. In prescribing our Christian response to this revolution, he went on in that article, quote, "We cannot follow Lot, who would have sacrificed his daughters to placate the aggressors." And today for you, my thesis is we have, in large part, done exactly what Dr. Jones warned us not to do back in 2000. We are sacrificing our children in the name of this ideology, and we must stop. We must refuse to play the part of Lot. Currently, our sons and daughters are being offered up in bathrooms, locker rooms, and on the sports field. More horrifically, we've placed them on the sacrificial operating table, something like an altar, feeding them poisons in the name of affirmation and cutting off their body parts to satisfy an ideology not based on the biblical truths of creation. Rather, it is based on the self-worship of men and women driven by lust and envy, which are inherent to the radical gender cult. So how do we stop making these sacrifices? In his article, Dr. Jones quoted a notable scholar, David A.J. Clines, a professor of Old Testament, who wrote in 1998, quote, "Though queer theory has yet to show its face at the Society of Biblical Literature, gayness is challenging all that we hold dear. When we begin to redraw the alterity map, the boundaries between same and different, we find ourselves having to think through everything and not just sexuality from scratch." Dr. Jones points out then that according to the postmodern hermeneutic, all meaning is socially generated. I'm here to tell you, postmodernism isn't based in reality. Thinking didn't give us the male-female distinction. Rather, the Creator brought this distinction into reality as the crowning achievement of all creation, making male and female in his own image. In the creation account in Genesis 1:27, the author suddenly bursts into poetry, stating the reality of humankind as his image bearers in a triplicate statement. He says it over and over again, three times, signifying how important it is for us to understand. Quote, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." But it doesn't just leave it there. Scripture goes on to explain the why of our creation as male and female. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And then it tells us, "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good." You and I and everyone, no matter how they identify, were created for a purpose. As male and female. And we can only fulfill that purpose as our created beings, male or female, defined by God. This is the reality in which we live. There's no amount of rethinking, feeling, reframing, reconsideration, medications, or surgeries that can undo this for us. Treating reality as theory or as an idea cannot unmake it. Reality is spoken into existence by divine power, by the unique Creator. And we can only suppress that truth and unrighteousness. We can't undo it. And I thank God for that. As Dr. Jones explained, pagans have always viewed distinctions, especially those between male and female, as the real fall. Therefore, salvation is found in erasing them. The old pagan religion has gained new power today with the advent of medical technology. My point is this: the spiritual impulse of the ancients no longer consists of fringe ritual castration and feminized priests performing their dark worship in small circles hidden away with the pagan elites. Now, the demand for living sacrifice has been launched culture-wide, reaching into every aspect of our lives. I had the pleasure of interviewing Claire Abernathy in 2025, and she and her mother have since then done an excellent interview with Independent Women's Forum, explaining the harrowing experience that they had when at just 12 years old, Claire became convinced that she was a boy trapped in a girl's body. Claire had experienced sexual trauma at that age, and she was also dealing with the regular discomfort almost every adolescent experiences as they grow from childhood into adulthood. By 14, Claire was on testosterone. Before she started her freshman year of high school, she'd also had a double mastectomy in the name of affirming her identity as a boy. Claire's sexual trauma and her mental health issues were never addressed by these interventions. Instead, she was fast-tracked through sex-rejecting medical procedures in the name of affirmative care. This was called life-saving care when they spoke to Claire's mother. And according to Carrie, her mother, she felt trapped into allowing her daughter to undergo these procedures. She explained in one interview, quote, "If my child's gonna kill herself, if I don't affirm her, I'm gonna do whatever I have to do to save my child's life." For her, there wasn't even a choice. It wasn't a question. As I spoke to Claire and I read that interview with her mother, I was reminded of another woman in California. Claire's from Texas. I met this woman only one time in 2022, and she told me a similar story. We were sitting at the table as our mutual friend had gone to use the restroom, and I asked, like moms tend to, "So, do you have any kids?" And she responded to me, "Yes, I've got two daughters. I have two kids. I had two daughters. Now I have a son and a daughter." And it took her that long to kind of get through this series of sentences. Over the course of half an hour, she explained that her youngest daughter had witnessed her older sister being sexually assaulted by that sister's boyfriend. Eventually, the young girl, who was also going through her parents' divorce, was so mentally distressed and agitated that she went to a counselor. Very quickly, after seeing that therapist, who ended up being a gender-affirming therapist, her daughter announced to her that she was trans. Her daughter was so distressed by seeing her own body when she undressed that she began to cover mirrors with towels and she would only shower in the dark. The girl's mother was terrified by her daughter's disintegrating mental state. The more they affirmed her, it didn't seem to get better. But she was convinced that the only way to help was to continue to affirm her in her male identity. And the power of this conviction, this is why I share this story, in person, 20 miles away from where they lived, with her daughter nowhere in sight, the power of that conviction was so strong that she religiously self-corrected her own language when saying her daughter's name or using her daughter's pronouns in reference to her. She was terrified. And these stories are not unique. Going back to Claire, who's now 21, she has detransitioned, but she lives with the consequences of trusting the medical establishment to determine what was best for her at the time. She suffers irreversible damage from having taken testosterone for so long. Previously a gifted singer in choir, Claire now has a deep masculine voice that breaks when she sings, and if she ever raises it, for instance, if she feels like she's in danger or needs to be heard for some reason. She had a double mastectomy, and it was done poorly, as I had described to you last night. The best doctors aren't the ones who are doing these surgeries, and so she experienced nipple graft rejection. She could not find doctors to help her with that until she was finally referred to an oncology ward, where doctors who actually deal with women with breast cancer could figure out what had gone wrong at the surgery center where she had had her, quote, gender-affirming care. She suffers from pelvic floor damage from testosterone. She has urinary tract issues that will not resolve. And she has physical discomfort from the way that her body, her sensitive parts of her body, overdeveloped because of her use of testosterone. So even now, years later, she has to choose her clothing based on what will cause her the least amount of pain each day. It's not which one will keep her from experiencing pain, it's the one that will cause her the least amount of pain during the day. All of the damage done to Claire was the predictable outcome of the sex-rejecting procedures she was told would change her from female to male. However, our medical associations, like so many institutions, have standards of care that are based on ideology, not science. Claire, like so many others, was an ideologically driven sacrifice. But even girls and boys who are not gender confused are affected by the demands of gender ideology. In our community of Escondido, I know a couple who has a son who is very embarrassed because a trans-identified girl was coming into the restroom while he was at the urinal. When he approached the administration, he was told that he could use the one single-use restroom that was on campus. It was so far away from where his classes were held that he couldn't use the bathroom during the day, and that was the only solution that was offered. That was in 2016. In the UK, there's a new trend of installing gender-neutral restrooms in schools. In 2019, parents and teachers spoke to the Daily Mail about this, describing girls who were refusing to drink any liquids during the day, just like these girls in North Carolina. And some girls described staying home entirely from school during their menstrual cycle because they were so ashamed to have to deal with those personal parts of their lives with males present. In Southern California, a current controversy surrounds the participation of a boy named A.B. Hernandez, who placed fourth in the nation, I believe, for girls his age, for the jumping that he did, while he would have placed in around like the 3,000th, tied with about 15 other boys, had he been competing according to his own sex. The only accommodation that the group that makes the policies in California for high school sports, the only accommodation that they were willing to make after my husband and many women and other fathers and advocates went to speak on behalf of the girls, was that girls could now, who won first place amongst their peers, could share the podium with the trans-identified boy and share the same medal with them. So there's an acknowledgement that there's something unfair going on here, but they're not willing to change it. My dear sister Amy Ichikawa, and I apologize, this is going to sound harsh, but it's the reality. Amy Ichikawa is a sister in Christ, and she's a staunch advocate for women are incarcerated with men all across the country. Men with violent repeat offenses against women are allowed to identify as women during their prison terms, and female inmates have now found themselves locked into cells with these predatory criminals. There are multiple instances documented of female inmates being raped, female guards being forced to strip search male inmates who identify as female at their own grave danger, and even female inmates being impregnated by their male cellmates. Amy has described the countless phone calls she gets every week. You see the exhaustion on her face because she answers every single one. Desperate female prisoners who are terrified because they've been punished for speaking out, they're being locked in with men, and they're terrified of what these men might do to them while they're in prison. As awful as all of this is, you might be questioning some of my framing on all of this, my framing of it as a sacrifice. So let's look back at Dr. Jones's warning to us about Lot. I realized up until just a couple of months ago, I thought that Lot was a righteous man. Lot was not a righteous man. Lot was being shown mercy because Abram had begged God not to destroy the city, and God couldn't find 10 righteous men. And so when he sent the angels, they only found Lot, and they were going to save Lot. And Lot pleaded with him because he was living in a place, sitting in the gates, knowing that it was so dangerous that he needed the men to come and stay in his house for the night, and then he wanted them to leave quickly the next day. So he wasn't living the way that the people were necessarily, but he was in it, and he was accommodating it, and he was trying to be okay there. So he asked the angels to come in. They finally agreed, and scripture tells us, but before the men lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house, and they called to Lot, "Where are those men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we may know them." And Lot went out to the men at the entrance, and he shut the door after him, and he said, "I beg you, brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you, and do to them as you please." By God's grace and the power of his angels, Lot's daughters were spared that terrible fate. But after being stricken blind by the angels with blindness, the men outside, quote, wore themselves out, groping at the door. I would argue, amongst many other things, it is reasonable to say that Lot was offering a sacrifice to appease the god of lust. The sex-crazed mob wanted to do sexual violence, and I shudder to think what would have happened had the angels not intervened, and I wonder, what exactly was Lot thinking? Did he honestly think that after his daughters were murdered violently by rape, that he and his family were going to live there safely for the rest of their days because the idols had accepted the sacrifice? Did he think that they would just leave them in peace for the rest of their days then? Clearly not. Clearly this was foolishness on his part to the deepest possible degree. And yet I believe that in countless small ways that we barely even notice anymore, and a few really big ways, we are doing the same when we accommodate the demands of radical gender ideology in our culture, in our homes, and even in our churches. The time constraints of this talk are going to require me to do a ridiculously broad bird's eye view of how we got to the point where we think about and treat gender-confused people the way that we do. But trust me, I have documentation for all of this. One of the original, most influential studies influencing gender-related medical policies we have today is called the Dutch Protocol. The Dutch Protocol was developed in the early 1990s, in large part because Dutch clinicians, and to set this for you, Dutch culture is extremely accommodating of the LGBTQ lifestyle. I can't think of another place that is more accommodating and of people who are more accepting of people who identify this way than you would find with the Dutch. And so this protocol was developed because Dutch clinicians found that adult men who had attempted to transition to female after they had gone through puberty reported low satisfaction with the results of their medical interventions because they couldn't actually pass as female due to the effects of male puberty. Male puberty makes your hands bigger. It gives you an Adam's apple. It changes things in such a way that people can still tell that you are not a woman. And that made them upset. These clinicians determined that if they intervened before puberty, they could get better results. Within this cohort of males who identify as transgender, I do need to explain something. There are two broad categories that drive what our culture thinks of as gender confusion. First, there are androphilic males who want to be seen as female. These males typically experience same-sex attraction. So they want to appear female so that they can attract men sexually as women would. The second category is autogynephilic males who derive sexual pleasure from appearing to themselves and other people as women. These men are still attracted to women, but passing as female and being perceived as female is an erotic experience for them. Broadly, what I'm saying to you is there is a sexual motivation at the root of many, if not most, males who experience gender dysphoria. There are other reasons, to be sure, I won't deny that, but that is a main driving factor. And so what this means for us today is to understand that the Dutch protocol, which has now been applied broadly as a standard of treatment across all people who experience gender confusion, was actually built in large part around male sexual paraphilia, a male sexual disorder of desire. This protocol was a foundational model for standards of care worldwide for gender-confused children. For example, the World Professional Association of Transgender Health changed its 8 standards of care, now known as the SOC 8, in 2022. Dutch clinicians contributed to nearly every chapter of the SOC 8, so that Dutch protocol is affecting what we do with our children here. However, it's important to note that the SOC 8 departed from the really strict guidelines for who got into the protocol in Holland, and they broadened it out, saying that basically gender needed to be treated with affirmative care. I want to remind for those of you who were here last night that we talked about the American Academy of Pediatric recommendations that removed age restrictions on affirmative care. They based that on the recommendations of WPATH and the SOC 8, which was affected by the Dutch protocols. One additional note regarding these revisions. When these changes were made, Dr. Mark Bowers, generally known as Marcy, was president of the World Professional Association of Transgender Health. And so too, Richard Levine, often referred to as Rachel, was the head of the Department of Health and Human Services for the Biden administration. While neither of these experts have publicly acknowledged the label, both have led lives that closely fit the profile for autogynephilia. In other words, some of the most influential voices in the standards of care for gender-confused children went through puberty, were married to women, had the blessing of fathering children before coming out as trans women, and then they drastically influenced and removed safeguards around ages because they wanted struggling children to be affirmed, to help them with their affirmation, and that's how kids are now being treated in the medical system. So while the Dutch protocol was developed in the 1990s, it wasn't until the 2010s that adolescent female identification as non-binary or transgender skyrocketed. When I first spoke about gender for Truth Exchange in 2021, here's just a sample of some of the statistics I had. In Sweden, there was a 1,500% increase in gender dysphoria amongst teenage girls since 2008. In the UK, girls seeking treatment for gender dysphoria had increased 4,415%. That was in 2021. More recently, a 2023 Center for Disease Control Youth Risk Behavior Survey revealed that about 5.5% of America's high schoolers identify as either transgender or questioning their gender. So when you do the math, that's a little over 900,000 teenagers in America, and it doesn't include kids who are in junior high and elementary school age, 900,000. And according to WPATH's recommendations, most of these kids should be affirmed without question in their gender dysphoria, and in many instances, that means that they will be put on a medical pathway. So I think that we need to ask ourselves, what are the risks of medicalization? Is it really bad for you, or are you just affirming someone and helping them? Well, in 2026, Finnish researchers did a comprehensive survey of all adolescents and young adults who'd contacted Finland's gender identity services. Again, a very affirming and open culture. They went back and looked all the way into the 90s to every person who had received gender treatment up to the present day. And this is the most extensive survey I'm aware of to date. I don't think there's another one that has been so thorough. But to begin with, severe mental health issues were far higher in the gender-referred cohort, aka those who were going to receive treatment, than in their peer controls. Before referral, the rates of severe mental health issues were 45.7% in referred patients compared to about 15% in the control cohort. Approximately 2 years later, after referral, once they'd received treatment, The rate went up to 61.7% of referred patients needing mental health interventions versus 14.6% in the control group. I know that's a lot of numbers and I'm not a numbery person, but what I'm trying to say to you is that treated patients got progressively worse while untreated peers got a little bit better. So the interventions made life worse and mental health worse for these kids. Psychiatric treatment needs went up drastically after medical intervention as well. For those receiving feminizing treatment, so males who feminized, their needs for medical health, mental health intervention went from 9.8% 2 years later to 60.7%. Let that difference sink in. It is very, very unhealthy for you to be affirmed in your gender delusions, because it's based on a lie. 0.6% of their cohort needing mental health interventions prior to treatment, and that number went up to 54.5%. In a large 2024 U.S. retrospective found that individuals who underwent sex-rejecting surgical interventions had a 12-fold higher risk of suicide attempts compared to those who had gender dysphoria but did not undergo surgery. With regard to mere social interventions like changing language to affirm children and their trans identities, kids who had no intervention, so people who spoke to them based on reality, based on their understanding of their trans identity, they resolved their gender dysphoria 85 to 90% of the time by the time that they were done with puberty. However, children who are affirmed with social transition went on to puberty blockers nearly 100% of the time. So language accommodations destabilize mental health and concretize delusions. This is iatrogenic harm. What that means is that the medical community considers social transition an active intervention, and that active intervention is causing medical harm. That's according to even very affirming medical groups like the Endocrine Society. Our language has consequences. Aside from mental health concerns and suicidality, which are compelling to me in and of themselves, we also have to consider the additional harm done by sex-rejecting medical interventions. None of them come out without dire health consequences, none of them. Puberty blockers, I'm just gonna give you a list, a bulleted list. Puberty blockers stunt growth. They result in bone density loss. We're seeing teenagers now with osteoporosis. They result in IQ and cognitive loss, negatively affect brain maturation, and seem to increase need for psychiatric intervention after use. And they block puberty, which is the very process by which many children understand themselves as embodied beings. Puberty helps kids understand themselves as embodied beings, and puberty blockers stop them from going through that process. When followed by cross-sex hormone therapy, they result in infertility and sexual dysfunction. And a note, Mark Bowers, the doctor of Jazz Jennings, who is the president of WPATH, was caught on a leaked tape to other health practitioners admitting that when he put his patients onto puberty blockers before Tanner stage 2, which is when puberty is getting ready to start, and then moved them onto cross-sex hormones, he was not aware of a single patient of his, and he had treated thousands at this point, not one patient who had ever achieved an orgasm. They were sexually shut down for the rest of their lives. Cross-sex hormones lead to cardiovascular problems, especially in feminizing men. Your rates of heart attack go up, your rates of stroke go up. There are all kinds of complications with cross-sex hormones. There are bone and metabolic risks. There are increased rates of breast cancer, higher diabetes rates, high rates of sterility, and there are irreversible effects on voice, breast growth in men that can be very painful. Sensitively, body part enlargement in women in sensitive areas that results in extreme pain, extreme torturous pain. 97% of girls and women who use chest binders report negative effects, such as back, chest, and shoulder pain, shortness of breath, skin irritation and breakdown, and ongoing posture issues. There are also reports of permanent tissue damage, so girls are having trouble lactating if they wore breast binders long term when they had a period of gender dysphoria, and girls have broken their ribs wearing these. Penis tucking, which has been openly discussed even for preschool-aged boys by parents on parenting forums that I have had to read through, can result in surface infections of skin, urinary tract infections, testicular torsion, hernias, and impaired fertility, amongst other issues. I talked about some of the details of the surgeries last night. I won't go through those again, but I will just say that the best doctors are not the ones who are doing these surgeries, and the failure rates are really, really high. And I would remind you that in Sweden, people who were post-surgical in the name of affirmation, their suicide rates were 19 times higher than their peers. And in the U.S. recently, they did a study that showed that they were 12 times higher here in the U.S. So the results of all of this are tragic, right? They're tragic for the people that we love who suffer from gender dysphoria. They're tragic for those of us who love them. And they're tragic for those who are affected by the changes that we've made in our culture to try to accommodate them in their confusion. And the proof, I think, that this is a self-protective religious movement is that statements of belief that are repeated like mantras receive, if they receive any pushback, there's violent backlash that comes at you. Slogans like trans women are women, protect trans kids, and gender-affirming care is life-saving care all require assent to ideas that are not borne out by truth or science. Trans women actually are male, and they cannot become otherwise, no matter how much medical intervention they receive. Trans kids actually are boys and girls who have believed a lie about themselves and will endure unimaginable suffering if we encourage them to go through procedures that are on this path that they've chosen for themselves. Gender-affirming care is not really care at all. Rather, treatments associated with trans aspiration harm and threaten the very lives that they're purported to protect. Terms such as, quote, sex assigned at birth, end quote, and, quote, believe trans people indicate that there is no creator God who has asserted his divine authority in creating with knowledge and love each and every male and female that bears his image. Rather, we should believe the testimony of men and women, boys and girls, who are telling us things that our observations fight against. And should anyone attempt to share alternative views, they're likely to encounter violent pushback. Some of what Rosaria has experienced, some of the things that I have experienced, there is real violence here. Take, for instance, Riley Gaines, who went to San Francisco State University to advocate on behalf of women's sports being preserved for women. It was a very simple message. Protesters flooded the event, and eventually Gaines was locked in a room for over 3 hours for her own protection before police could get her off the campus. And as she waited to evacuate, the protesters stood outside, and they were pounding on the doors to get in. I was at the event I told you about last night in 2022, where like-minded men and women were trying to get scientific packets into the hands of doctors. That's what we were trying to do. And when the detransitioners who had come with us got up to tell their stories, their experiences of what this medicine had done to them, the protesters, dressed in Antifa gear, suddenly appeared and began to shout over bullhorns and try to provoke physical altercations with us. We had to be evacuated into a safe room with security guards. And as detransitioner Chloe Cole, who has since become our dear sister in Christ, tried to gather herself at 16 years old to tell the story of what had been done to her, they were pounding on the doors until they were removed by security. And I think of Lot, considering how to appease the mob trying to tear down his door. And I think of us, dear brothers and sisters. How have we attempted to appease this mob pounding at our doors? We are being pressured to hand over our language, our institutions, our consciences, our rights, and our children, all in the hopes that at some point the demands will stop, that at some point those people clamoring at the doors will be satisfied, and they will not be satisfied because they are false gods and they are never satisfied. They always, always, always need another sacrifice. So what do we do? We need to establish in our own minds in a way that by the power of the Spirit makes us strong, without hesitation, without doubt, biologically and theologically, that there is no person on earth who is transgender. And every action and every word that we speak must convey that truth because we love them and we want to see them saved. We've discussed the biology, but I need to address the theology here quickly. You're at a Truth Exchange conference, so we start with Romans 1:25. We exchange the truth about God for the lie. I want you to note there is one truth and there is one lie. It's a binary choice. And they worshiped and served created things rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. Immediately, Paul goes on to describe what happens when we make this exchange, and Rosaria went over this too. Quote, "For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women who were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error." And I cannot read these verses without thinking of the first six chapters of Genesis. In Genesis 1:27, we are told that God created us male and female in his image. But then after that pinnacle of creation, Genesis 3 happens, and Adam and Eve doubt God's goodness. They believe the lie that they could be like God. They eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the resulting curses disrupt that beautiful complementary design that God made for male and female. Eve, once a perfect helper fit for Adam, now desired his place. She desired almost his role. There's a sense of that in the language from the commentaries that I've read. And Adam, once a protector and a provider, became an oppressor who was going to rule over her. There was no complementarity between their relationship anymore. But I want you to notice something. The binary of male and female was not undone. Males remained males, and females remained females. A man wanting desperately to be a woman is not proof that he is a woman by the strength of his desire. Rather, his desire proves that he's a man under the curse of sin, just like the rest of us. And a woman who desires to be a man does not prove that she's a man by the strength of her desire and her passion to believe it. Rather, her desire proves that she's a woman under the curse of sin. Times once by a trans-identified man who believed that he was a woman in a book by an author named Abigail Favall called The Genesis of Gender, which I liked and didn't like. I think you didn't love it. There were some interesting things in it, but he insisted that he was female because something about the fall had changed the male-female binary. But here's the interesting thing. God doesn't allow for that at all. Because even after sin comes, even after Cain kills Abel, Seth is born. And when Seth's line is reiterated in the Bible, in chapter 5, guess what we hear? When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Male and female, he created them. And he blessed them, and they named them man when they were created. The binary remained. It was not changed. And it was proven in Genesis 6 that the binary was maintained through the flood. There are only males and females. I want you to know theologically as well as biologically that there are no trans men or women, and there are no trans kids. There are only men and women just like you and me who are being hunted by sin and lies. And if they don't know the truth, if no one is brave enough to tell them the truth, death is knocking at their door. In John 8:44, Jesus said he, Satan, was a murderer from the beginning. And he does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. Believing lies will quite literally be the death of us. And I'm aware that there must be people here today who love sons and daughters, grandsons and granddaughters, nieces and nephews, or neighbors, or classmates, or coworkers, just like I do, who believe sincerely that they are transgender. And I am aware that some of you may have compromised with the lie because you were scared for them, just like Claire's mom was scared for her. The truth is, if you affirm these people, they will be done harm more than they will be done good. Proverbs 27:6 says, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but profuse are the kisses of an enemy." And what do enemies want? They want to destroy you. And many of us accommodate changes in our language, boys playing in girls' sports, Jazz Jennings being mutilated and gaslit on TV for adoring audiences, because we don't want to get political. We don't want to rock the boat. The truth is that we're participating in that perpetual sacrifice of the lie when we accommodate these things. I recently watched a video in which a young man testified to the governor of his state about the effects of the medical treatments he underwent pursuing his transgender identity. His mother sat next to him as he spoke, and I watched her face while he was telling his story. And it was as though every time he described another one of his symptoms, which were severe and the list was long, she was receiving a physical blow and nodding her head because she had assented to all of it. God created each of these people, male or female, in his image. I cannot say it enough. And they are experiencing deep and horrendous pain. But I've seen believing parents who've refused to affirm the lie. And I'm reminded of Paul, who begged the Lord to remove the thorn from his flesh. And the Lord told him no, and this is what he said: "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. And that is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weakness, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Isaiah 40:29 says he gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. And I've seen the truth of this as friends of mine make plans for their prodigals to come home with scars and needing extra medical care, as they beg others to pray for their children even as they pray for them, and as they speak the truth in love and refuse to bow to the pressures to accommodate.